Hey, this is talking with Dennis Welsh on 12th August 76 at Jodrell Bank. Now, can you tell me when you began at Jodrell as a postgraduate student, I guess?
I came here in 1953, October, and I was a graduate student continuously until January 1957.
And were you a physics
I had been a physics student at Manchester prior to coming to Jodrell Bank, yes.
And when you arrived at Jodrell Bank, how were you shunted, or what exactly does a new student do at that stage?
Well, I was essentially assigned to study a particular problem. My supervisor was Humphrey Brown.
Mm-hmm.
There were about three or four students who came that year to work for PhDs, plus several other students doing master's degrees. And at that time, Jodrell was heavily financed. I would say more than 50% of the effort was to study meteors in the upper atmosphere. The radio astronomy, as such, was, as opposed to radar astronomy, was a smaller fraction
right.
of the effort, but it was growing
but
fast.
But it was changing fast.
It was growing fast, and the changeover occurred, I guess, during my years here. The old 218-foot diameter transit telescope mm-hmm. here then, and it had been in use at that time at 158 megahertz, used by Humphrey Brown and Hazzard for several years to do their studies of extragalactic nebulae and so forth.
Right.
And Cyril Hazzard was just finishing his term here at that point. He was here until 1953, then he left. He was away for a couple of years and came back in 1955. I took over in some ways the sort of work that he had been doing. And the first thing I did was to build some new equipment to convert the 218-foot telescope to operation at 92 megahertz.
And why go to the lower frequency?
Well, there were several reasons. The main one, as I recall, was that with a transit telescope, you move the beam by tilting the mast. And as you, in any fixed power, if you move away from the focus, you get aberrations coming in, which is color. And you can just move a limited number of beamers before that becomes too severe.
Right, I see.
And if you go to low frequency, you have a broader beam, you can go more beam tilts. As I recall it, about 10 beamlets, you could draw something of that, 10 beamlets or thereabouts. You could tilt it before it became,
So it gave you more sky coverage.
That's right, yeah. And there was a particular object, in fact, that we were interested in at that point. The Cygnus Loop is an old supernova remnant. It's one of the biggest and best known of these.
Was it known to be that at that time?
Yes. I think it was, that was what it was believed to be.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's no doubt now, I don't think there's much doubt now, the work has written papers on it and so forth, oscillating that it was suggesting that it was a supernova of, I think, something like 50,000 years
mm-hmm.
old or thereabouts. And I think that just before I came here, Professor Kopal in Manchester had suggested to Ruffin and Humphrey Brown that this is something we ought to look at. As a possible radio source,
because
of course there were very few identified radio sources at that time.
Right.
Any new one was a big capture. And that was the main reason for changing down to 92 megahertz, because that was at zenith distance of something over 20 degrees, about 23 degrees I think.
Uh-huh. So you just had to reach it, yeah.
So I spent my first year, or most of it, building changing frequency to 92 megahertz and improving the receiver that existed very considerably.
This would be more sensitivity than any of the low frequency all sky surveys that had been done, or were there?
Yes, it was greater sensitivity because the collecting area bigger than any other telescope was in existence at
right.
the time. And it also had higher resolution, better narrow primary beam
right.
than anything else. So comparable at such a low frequency at the time. Well, I spent the first year or so building the receiver, making it work, and then I did the observation, and in fact we detected the signal loop as a discrete source.
I have here that it was several degrees wide.
Yes, it was about, I estimated it was about 3 degrees wide.
Yeah, 3 to 6 degrees, the abstract says.
Does it?
And the abstract also says it's questionable, or it's suggested that this might be the signal loop. It's not definite. Why were you somewhat uncertain?
I don't think we were, but I mean, an extended object might not. Now, our position accuracy, I suppose, was perhaps a degree or thereabouts.
Yeah.
One has to be a little cautious.
Right.
Building really began.
What other supernova remnants were there at that time? Cass, of course.
Well, it wasn't known for sure that Cass was a supernova remnant. It was speculated, but it certainly wasn't known. I don't think it was until...
Well, by the time you published it, the spectra were in hand, but that's right, there still was an argument, though, even once the...
Yeah, I think it was several years before it was really accepted. I spoke to Spassky about that time, was doing his work.
That's right.
That took a little while before it diffused to the west, I guess. The Crab Nebula, of course, was an astounding one. Tycho's supernova had been detected by Henry Graham Hazard. I think Kepler's hadn't.
Did John Baldwin have one of those at that time? Yes, that's right.
Yeah, I think pretty easy detected IC443, which again was, at that time, I think, my memory was rusty after 20 years.
That's all right. I'll check anything.
I would not be quoted.
Right.
But I think if I went back to it, it would suggest it was very possibly a supernova remnant, but it wasn't absolutely certain. But certainly, I think I'm right in believing that John Baldwin, in that Nature letter, did suggest that it was very similar in appearance, or point out that it was very similar in appearance to the Cygnus loop.
I see. So now you've got the figure out here showing your source position versus the optical.
Yeah, the pleasing thing here was that the optical object, as it was known to me at that point, consisted primarily of this sort of pair of brackets.
To the northeast and northwest,
yeah. And I was struggling to get position accuracy, and whatever I did, I kept coming out distinctly below one of the two prominent features there.
Right.
And I thought I had an extent of about 3 degrees, 2 or 3 degrees. The minimum I could have done was to get around the circle, which is what?
3 degrees.
3 degrees, yeah.
Minimum angular diameter of 3 degrees.
Yeah.
And the positional error of the center is plus or minus 1 degree in deck and quarter of a degree in
something like
RA.
That. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And about this time, the Palomar-Schmidt was coming into operation, and Minkowski sent us after I'd done the publication and got my rating, he sent us a picture of the signal.
Ah, yes.
And lo and behold, there's the two common things, but there's a lot of nebulosity down there showing the extent really was much greater than the extent.
And the radio position was really right in the middle.
Yeah. It's pretty big, so I got quite.
But that wasn't in this 55 Nature article, the Minkowski result.
Just hold on a minute, just check.
Okay. So in the Nature article, it looks like you did not know about Minkowski's results.
No, at that point we didn't, and it looked as though we might be degrees off in position. Our best estimate position was perhaps a degree wrong, just by looking at the optical material, but when we got Minkowski's print from Palomar-Schmidt, why it showed a lot more material further south, and that we were pretty near the geometrical centre of the thing.
So this was the first project on the 218 foot, and then what came next?
Well, I started a survey just of the whole region that was available in the by talking about the primary feed by moving the primary feed from the focus an area of about plus or minus 20 degrees in declination. I started to do a survey of discrete sources in that area
at 92 megahertz.
Yes, it looks as though most of the sky went from about 26 up to 73, 72 or 73 degrees of declination.
And what was the purpose of this survey?
Well, several purposes, to find discrete sources, to try and, at that point we're thinking about, try and map the distribution of galactic radiation.
Mm-hmm.
This stretch covered a wide range from the North Atlantic Pole to right of the equator. so we were had a big chunk. But in fact, about this time, 1955, the Cambridge 2C survey was published.
Right.
And this caused a lot of excitement because one of the things, it had this very steep slope of log N log S curve, which Cambridge people attributed to non-steady state cosmology, which of course is a very controversial subject for that.
Right.
So we thought I carried on to do the survey so we could do a comparison with 2C. And it quickly became apparent when we got the 2C catalogue that they were, on the face of it, seeing far more sources than we were.
Mm-hmm.
And it was also fairly clear that in the response curve of a single source of ours, they would have two or three sources. And it's hard to see why they should have so many when their primary beam was about the same as ours. I don't know the precise figures, but it mm-hmm. wasn't greatly different from my primary beam.
And the frequencies were very similar too.
Well, they were 158, 159 megahertz.
No, 2C was at 80, wasn't it? Yes, and 3C.
So I beg your pardon, yes, you're quite right. Yes. That's right, yes, it was at 81 megahertz.
Yeah.
So
here you had a direct comparison that could be made.
Yeah.
In a similar sense to how Mills is.
I've got the figures here. Total, the solid angle of the total power beam, that's my beam, is 7.5 square degrees. That's the interferometer. And 11.8 square degrees for the Cambridge lobe envelope.
Mm-hmm.
Along for the fact that each half of the Cambridge interferometer consists of two elements. So they were comparable.
Right.
Mine, if anything, was fractionally better than theirs. And so the question was, why the discrepancies? I mean, there were enormous discrepancies. The strongest sources, which I could see, were right, but the lower amount, there certainly were large discrepancies. And it looked as though they perhaps got into difficulties that we didn't really understand through using an interferometer.
But where does Mills's work fit in here?
Mills produced his first list round about this time, and he did not get this deep slope of, I think it was 2.5 or 3 that the Cambridge registrometers.
2.8, I think, was the number.
2.8 is the time.
Was the number.
Okay.
But I'm trying. You and Mills essentially started up independently on a check on the 2C. Is that
well,
fair to say that?
Mills did a survey, which, as I recall, Paulie report on Bolton, one of the other reported here at Guttle Bank in the IU Symposium. He had a slope of, I think, 1.5,
mm-hmm.
or something very near the simple-minded one.
But was this before your work got involved?
Well, my work was underway at the time.
But you didn't really have any results that you could compare right then?
I didn't have results to compare at that time.
Okay.
The observations were made during the period 1955 September to 1956 May. That is the total power set of the...
So you began right after that conference here in general?
I did, in fact, yes.
Yeah.
But I think we had planned to do this earlier, and it's difficult for me to remember the details now, but I think that the telescope was in use for the purposes for a while. I didn't have access to it. And then during that summer, we made some changes at the focus so we could put up two separate feeds at different frequencies, work simultaneously at two frequencies.
Mm-hmm.
So it became possible for a student doing another project and me, it became possible for us to work simultaneously, or at least time share.
Who was that student?
It was Dick Thompson, A.R. Thompson, mm-hmm. who's now at NREL. During that winter, 55 to 56, I did a pencil beam survey. We already had samples prior to that which showed that it's difficult for us to harmonize our observations with the 2C observations. During that winter, it quickly became apparent as we went along that we were seeing major discrepancies, and began to wonder what, if any, effects you might get due to confusion with the interferometer that you didn't get with the total power system,
right,
the pencil beam system.
And when you say we, who are you?
Cyril Hazard had joined me during that summer. He came back to Total Bank in the summer of 1955,
mm-hmm,
to be in preparation for observing with the Mark 1 telescope, which was due to be completed in the near future. And in fact, he came and joined me on work I was doing.
Was he your supervisor?
No. Humphrey Brown was my supervisor. Well, we decided that a good thing to do would be to build the interferometer ourselves and see what we could see with it. So we used the 2 18-foot dish as one element, and we built a small array in the field northwards of it, northwest of it, in fact. Well, not in the exact, it's more north than west. Which had just about the same spacing as the 2C interferometer. The spacing and wavelength, that is. So it had the same mode separation. And then we did a separate survey of the whole area again with this interferometer, which we analysed independently.
Mm-hmm. You mean you and Hazard?
Yes. Now that work began while I was here at Jodrell in sometime in 1956, in the latter part of the year. The interferometer survey was carried out in the period 1956 October to 1957 May.
Right.
And I left Jodrell in the middle of that, and there were many observations were carried out primarily by Hazard, and I came back weekends and so forth to give a hand and to look at the data and so on. And then we did an analysis comparison of these two surveys, analyzed each independently and compared results to look for discrepancies where they arose, and what we found in fact was that they arose at a much higher flux density level than certainly the Cambridge astronomers had appeared to believe.
Right.
They had extended their source far below what we would have regarded as a safe flux density level to avoid the effects of confusion. And we had a rough rule of thumb that once you got to the density of source on the sky equivalent to about 1 per 25 beam areas, then you began to get very serious discrepancies. That is to say, spurious sources appearing, missing sources
right.
over there.
You came to this conclusion, shortly after you completed your survey?
Yes. From the comparison of the interferometer and total
right.
power surveys. And
were you surprised by that? I mean, were you surprised at confusion?
No. I think we had mentally decided previously that, just from comparing our survey with the Cambridge Radiostronomers survey, I mean, there were the published results of their survey,
right.
but looking at our records, we realized they couldn't possibly see that many numbers.
Okay, so.
Just.
And having activity. More faith in yours, you were not surprised then when.
That's right.
But what about before you even began the survey? Were you surprised that.
Well,
could be so
before
bad.
I began the systematic survey in late 1955, I don't think I was surprised, but you see, we'd already done some scans. We've got some file scans for various purposes that we got in the year previous. So when Cambridge produced their 2C list, we looked in the areas that we covered. And they were obviously seeing far more sources per unit area than we could possibly expect to be able to resolve. And so I was suspicious immediately. I remember Minkowski coming to Jodrell Bank and looking at some of my records, and he was obviously quite convinced that Cambridge people had gone too far with their 2C survey.
When was this? Was this for this meeting?
This
was, it
was about the time of the meeting. I couldn't be precise about
because you
the
began your observations just after the meeting.
Well, yes, but I had to have
trial.
I'd done samples,
yeah.
but not a whole systematic survey of a large area prior to that. I can't remember the precise date when Minkowski was here, but I remember sitting down at my desk with him and going through some records. And he obviously believed that the 2C survey had gone much too far.
So it sounds like then that you were, all right from the very beginning, you were very suspicious
That's right, yes. And also I did some very simple-minded calculations of the density of sources and Poisson statistics and distribution and so forth that suggested that by the time you got to that sort of flux density level, when you got to that sort of density right. sources, that you would be in difficulties.
And, picking them up in fringes right
now. Yeah. Come on.
This is continuing the interview on Friday the 13th of August. So you say you're not really sure then why Cambridge didn't come to a similar conclusion?
No, I don't know.
In very early stage.
I think they were over-optimistic and I don't know why.
It's rather strange. I mean, a lot of people there, a lot of bright people.
That's right. I just don't have an explanation, sorry.
Okay. Mills's survey and yours, did they essentially agree, would you say, the MSH results, or were they different in some ways?
Well, there was no overlap between them. We were surveying completely different parts of the sky, so we could not do a direct comparison. I don't think one could really make a comparison between our measurements. I did not measure a number versus flux density statistic curve. I didn't attempt to produce that. I didn't have enough sources. I didn't have enough statistical weight to do this. He produced a log in log S curve with a slope of 1.5 or something close to that.
Right.
I think that what we did was try to just go over the same piece of sky with the total beams, with a total power pencil beam system and interferometer, make comparisons and find out at what level they diverge.
Yeah, that was really the unique thing about yours, is that the same group did it both ways.
That's right, and we eliminate a lot of systematic variables by using the same, basically the same beam width defined by the 218 foot paraboloid, which we went over to the interferometer, and things like that, so that we thought we'd narrowed down some of the things that might produce systematic errors.
Mm-hmm. Were there any more results from your thesis research than what we've talked about in the primary conclusions?
Well, there are little things that, for example, a matter of technique. I used a system that, as far as I know, I was the first person to use this, although it's kind of on application later, and that is using a dual beam system.
Beam switching, essentially.
Beam switching between two adjacent, we had two adjacent feeds up at the focus and switching between them, and that's one of the records.
So here's one of the records,
yeah. That was done in 1954, and that was used specifically for, I put that specifically calibrated Cygnus loop, which, because one of the problems with observing that with pencil beam system, as pencil beam record, is that it's sitting on a fairly steep slope on the side of the galactic plane.
Right.
And picking out a slope is tricky. Whereas if you use a split beam system, beam switching system, you take out the gradient, you take out the first derivative.
Right.
And so that was a record of the Cygnus loop, was really convinced us maybe more than anything that we'd seen it.
But with such an extended object, one had to be careful not to subtract part of the object from itself, too.
Yeah. It came out pretty nicely, I think. Remember our beam width was about 3 degrees wide.
Oh, that's true. That's pretty big.
I mean, you can see the comparison between just, that was my best single pencil beam record, and that was dual beam record, and it shows up much more vividly than that.
I noticed that figure is captioned the intense source in Cassiopeia. It looks like the nomenclature Cassiopeia A was not that standard at that time. It had been introduced by Bolton way back in the late 40s.
Well, yeah, it had been adopted, I think, in 1955, hadn't it, by IAU, but I don't know it. I guess I haven't got used to using it. I've forgotten why. I think perhaps we just haven't got used to using it.
And what else was there? From this thesis work?
Well, I think that's most of it. We've got some records here, which these are just records, part of the survey.
Well, let me ask you about the Paris Symposium. You and Hazard gave a talk on your...
Yes, I wasn't present at the...
Oh, that was Hazard, actually.
Hazard.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
So I should really ask him this, because after the paper in the proceedings, there's quite a lively discussion about total power versus interferometric techniques, and I wanted to ask you about that, but you weren't actually there.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a shame. So, having finished your thesis, what was the next step for you?
I submitted my thesis a year after I'd left Jodrell. I was working in the Ministry of Frontiers and coming back quite frequently. And it was in that year when I came back in 1957 that the Mark I first, my only observation first came into operation.
Mm-hmm.
And I was here the night the first record ever was taken with that telescope. Which it was at the Zenith, the Italian Road, but the receiver was up there that I had designed. And the first receivers used on there were Chinese copies made in our workshops of the receiver that I'd built and used for this thesis work.
What kind of receiver?
It was a Ralph Humbert type receiver. It was nothing special.
Right.
It used a mechanical rotating capacitor switch. I can't remember the details of the circuitry I designed. So the basic circuitry that followed it. Nothing terribly clever, but it was a lot better than the one Harry Brown had used before me. And so he had a workshop make up a couple of copies of it at 92 MHz, 158 MHz. He used it with the Mark I telescope.
So the first, it was at 158 MHz, the first observation, right?
Well, I'm not really sure at this point whether it was 158 or 92 that went on first. I think it probably was 158 that went on the Mark I first. I was here one evening in the summer, about this time of the year, July or August. And that first observation was amazing. I remember Humber Brown, he couldn't believe it, he'd never seen such a perfect record, free from interference and so forth. And it wasn't very usual.
What was the source?
Oh, it wasn't any particular source, it was just the magnetic plane going through the...
Part of the Zenith, so from any particular source. Mm-hmm.
I guess... I guess there are various odd intense sources going through the Zenith, HD295, but I don't think that was looked at particularly on occasion.
Yeah. So the Mark I came into operation, and did this affect what you were going to do? I mean, your research program? Or?
I'd left then. I was just tying up the remains of my thesis and the finishing up the interferometric observations and doing the analysis of them, going back to use the library, that kind of thing. So I really wasn't involved with the new things that were going on. I'd left Jodrell. I stayed in touch. Quite a while because Alfred Montague was a paper in the Paris Symposium by Hazard and Walsh, which Hazard did put that paper together by and large, but I was involved somewhat in it.
Sure.
I